Hello, and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, from Religion News Service, the Associated Press, and more. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the Washington Post dated September 20th. The headline on this article, "The U.S. once forced this Native American tribe to move. Now they're getting their land back." This is by Marissa Iotti of the Washington Post. The humble-looking mission church in the middle of a cemetery was built two centuries ago with $1,333 and Native Americans' labor. John Stewart, a Methodist and the son of slaves, had dreamed that God told him to travel north from his home in Marietta, Ohio, until he met a people who needed him. Inspired by this message he believed was from God, Stewart walked until he reached the city of Upper Sandusky in the state's northern region and encountered the Wyandot Nation. Stewart began preaching and singing to the Wyandots in 1819, and soon was joined by the Reverend James Finley, who asked the U.S. government to fund a church for the natives on tribal land. The government provided the money, and the Methodists' Wyandot Indian Mission was born. For the next two decades, the Wyandots worshipped and learned at the church, which doubled as a school. When the Indian Removal Act in 1843 forced the Wyandots to move west, they sold about 109,144 acres in Ohio and 4,996 acres in Michigan to the U.S. government. They also deeded 3 acres of their land to what is now the United Methodist Church to secure the house and the place where we have buried friends from being desecrated, according to the deed. 2 centuries after the Methodists first encountered the Wyandots, the church plans to return the historical site to the tribe on Saturday. The transaction is unusual. Although Native Americans have frequently been forced to give up their property, land transfers rarely move in the other direction. No money will be exchanged for the tract, which includes the Mission Church and part of what is now the Old Mission Cemetery. Methodists continued to use the church until 1847 and then temporarily abandoned it because of its poor condition. They restored the building in 1889. I think the Wyandots knew that the Methodists were the ones that built the church, and they were the ones that showed genuine compassion toward them. So who better to leave it in the hands of than the UMC, said Billy Friend, chief of the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma. And looking back, I think that was the best thing that we had done. The Wyandot Nation, based in the town of Wyandot, Oklahoma, has about 6,600 members. The Oklahoma members make up the federally recognized tribe, while other bands of Wyandots in Kansas and Michigan are not federally recognized as tribes. Other Wyandots live across the United States. The tribe left Ohio 2 centuries ago only after several failed attempts by the U.S. government to persuade them to move west of the Mississippi River. The Wyandots eventually came to think that acquiescing to the government's demands offered their only chance of maintaining their tribal identity. Deeding the 3 acres of land back to the Wyandot Nation acknowledges the tribe's historical relationship with the United Methodist Church and the suffering its members endured when the government made them leave. An event celebrating the transfer will feature a march through town, a pipe ceremony, asking the Creator to bless the ground, a tribal dance exhibition, and the tribal princess reciting the Lord's Prayer in tribal sign language. The UMC this year is celebrating 200 years of missions, of which John Stewart's ministry among the Wyandots was the first. The anniversary made Thomas Kemper, the church's General Secretary of Global Ministries, pay renewed attention to the deeded land and decide it was time to return it to the tribe. Although the Methodists' interactions with the Wyandots were largely positive, Kemper said giving back the property is partly an act of repentance for times when Methodists mistreated Native Americans, sometimes badly. Colonel John Chivington, for example, was a Methodist who led a group that killed about 230 Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians in the 1864 Sand Creek Massacre. "People have been killed, and we have been complicit in this," Kemper said. "This giving back of land is not taking anything away from this responsibility that we have as Methodists in this system. To fulfill its responsibility to Native Americans, the church also works on preventing suicide among young Native people, among other causes." A group of Methodists in Upper Sandusky has been caring for the Mission Church and the surrounding cemetery where Stewart is buried since the Wyandotte's departure. Weekly services are still held at the church in the summers. After the Wyandottes regain ownership of the property, they plan to apply for the U.S. government to hold the land in a trust. This ownership agreement, which is the most common one for tribal land, provides legal safeguards for the property. The Wyandottes also intend to seek National Historic Landmark status for the land. Since 2007, friends said Wyandotte High School and college students, as well as tribal elders, have traveled to Upper Sandusky from the reservation in Oklahoma to learn about the Wyandottes' history. Members of the tribe learned to read and write at the Mission Church, friends said, and two tribal chiefs became ordained missionaries themselves. Stewart met the Wyandottes at an important time for the tribe. A highly respected chief had just died, friends said, and the aftermath of the War of 1812 created a sense of the unknown. Stewart's preaching made the Wyandottes think that perhaps God was watching over them and had sent someone else to lead them. Nobody knew what the future held for Indian people, a friend said. So when John Stewart came and began to preach hope and compassion and love, I think that was something that our people needed to hear at that time. Many Wyandottes previously had converted to Catholicism when missionaries from the Jesuit religious order visited, said Mary Stockwell, author of The Other Trail of Tears, The Removal of the Ohio Indians. So when the Methodists came, she said, the tribe members found their Christianity comfortingly familiar. They appreciated the missionaries' emphasis on nonviolence, strong marriages, and temperance. Unlike later generations of missionaries who considered indigenous people to be beneath white settlers, Stockwell said the Methodists respected the Wyandottes' culture and traditions. This generation of missionaries, they didn't have that superior mentality, she said. They had a mentality of, we're all equal, we're all the same. At the mission school, boys learned how to be commercial farmers who grew corn, tended to orchards, and raised livestock. Some families used the knowledge to start their own individual farms, Stockwell said. The girls learned to sew and to take care of a household, just as non-native girls were learning at that time. By the time President James Monroe left office in 1825, relations between Native Americans and white Americans were uneasy. Members of both groups were telling the president they couldn't coexist. The whites complained that the Native Americans were not assimilating. The Native Americans worried that the white Americans would overwhelm them. President Andrew Jackson in 1830 signed the Indian Removal Act, forcing indigenous tribes to move west of the Mississippi River. He sent volunteers to negotiate with the Wyandottes three times over the next several years, and the Wyandottes repeatedly refused to budge. When one of their young chiefs was killed by white hunters, the Wyandottes decided they had to leave so they could retain their tribal identity. In their final weeks in Ohio, Stockwell said, the Wyandottes frequently prayed at the Mission Church before they moved to Kansas. There's 573 tribes in our nation, and all of us have our own trail of tears, friend said. This was kind of the beginning of our trail of tears in Ohio. We continue on religion in the news this week with an article from September 30th by Yonat Shimron of Religion News Service. This article is headlined, "It Services This Rosh Hashanah, a Familiar Social Justice Refrain." As Jews take their seats at Rosh Hashanah services today, some will be handed a postcard addressed to U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, urging her to resist President Trump's cruel immigration policies. Just sign and mail. At other synagogues, Jews will be asked to consider the Jewish New Year as a period of environmental teshuva, the Hebrew word for repentance, by taking steps such as eating less meat and using less plastic. These are just a few of the scores of social justice causes American Jews have taken up in the name of their faith over the past year, including calls to shut down immigration and customs enforcement offices, demand gun control measures, address white nationalism, protect abortion rights, and scores of other liberal agenda items. They underscore a reality of American life. Jews lean liberal and vote with the Democratic Party. That reality has changed little, even as the Trump White House has attempted to peel Jewish voters away from the Democratic Party and as the left has indulged in anti-Semitic rhetoric. In 2018, nearly 80% of Jewish voters cast ballots for Democratic candidates for the House of Representatives, according to exit polls. Jews strongly supported Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential campaign, preferring the Democratic candidate by 71%. President Donald Trump earned only 24% of their vote. Those results continue a trend that is at least two decades old, Pew Research surveys show. If anything, some polls indicate, Trump's efforts to accuse Jewish voters of disloyalty if they voted for Democrats will likely backfire. In parentheses, if you want to vote Democrat, you are being very disloyal to Jewish people and very disloyal to Israel, Trump said on August 21st. 42% of American Jews said they thought Trump is favoring the Israelis too much, according to a recent Pew poll. With obvious exceptions, especially among Orthodox Jews, American Jews do not think Trump's recent actions on behalf of Israel, which include moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights region, are the right way to help the Jewish state. Perhaps more fundamentally, the Republican Party's embrace of Christians, and particularly evangelicals, reinforces Jewish voters' preference for the Democratic Party. Jews believe it's the secularity of the state as they understand it that makes the difference, said Kenneth Wald, an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Florida and the author of The Foundations of American Jewish Liberalism. They get very aroused when anything comes out that suggests this is a Christian country, he added. That's been a fundamental problem with the Republicans. They're now associated with this notion of the United States as a Christian nation. Others agree that strong support for separation of church and state guides American Jewish leanings, but they say anti-Semitism may be an even bigger factor these days. Following the massacre of 11 Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last October and the shooting inside the Chabad of Poway, California Synagogue in April that killed one woman and injured two others, security measures are high as Jews flock to high holy day services this year. Beginning Sunday evening with the start of the 10 Days of Awe, some Jews will be walking through metal detectors for the first time. Others will notice security cameras, a beefed-up police presence, even undercover Israeli security agents. That, too, has apparently only strengthened Jewish liberal leanings. Most Jews associate President Trump with the increase in anti-Semitism since the 2016 election, said Herbert Weisberg, emeritus professor of political science at The Ohio State University. It's not that he's anti-Semitic, but he gives the green light for anti-Semites to act on their views. Trump's defense of white nationalists at the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, "You also had some very fine people on both sides," he said, may have permanently tarnished his image among many Jews. Some protested the president's visit to Pittsburgh after the shooting, claiming he shared responsibility for the attack. But concern is growing among many Jews about what they perceive to be anti-Semitic comments by U.S. Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, the two Democratic legislators who are both Muslim, for their support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement aimed at Israel. The Congresswomen's perceived anti-Semitism has become part of Trump's strategy to divide Jews by suggesting that only the Republican Party will protect them. If the eventual Democratic Party candidate for president takes a tough stand on Israel's policy, said Lauren B. Strauss, professor of modern Jewish history at American University, I'm wondering if that will push people away from voting Democratic and toward ideals and policies that are still seen as more conservative and less civil libertarian. Movements on the left, such as TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, which sponsored the postcard campaign to Nancy Pelosi, and other new groups such as Never Again Action, which has led close to 40 protests intended to shut down ICE, do not represent the majority of American Jews, Strauss said, who are not as liberal as they may seem. But so far, the GOP hasn't convinced many Jews who see anti-Semitism on the right from white supremacists as a far greater threat. Indeed, last week, the Trump administration gave Jews more reason to swing left by announcing it would slash refugee admissions to 18,000, the lowest in nearly four decades. The Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, the lobbying arm of the nation's largest Jewish denomination, swiftly denounced the move, calling it shameful. Other groups have cited the immigrant history of most American Jews as a reason to stand in solidarity with those fleeing war, poverty, and discrimination today. Which is why many Jews will be mailing postcards to Nancy Pelosi. Rabbi Michael Rothbaum of Congregation Beth Elohim in Acton, Massachusetts, 25 miles northwest of Boston, came up with the postcard project. To date, about 30,000 have been mailed to various synagogues across the country. How do we get involved? Asked Rothbaum, who leads a non-denominational synagogue. Here's an easy way. Sign a postcard. Because of our history as an immigrant people and because of our texts, this is a no-brainer. Next on Religion in the News, a short article from the New York Times dated September 17th. The headline, St. John the Divine Cathedral is in recovery mode. The subheadline, while all eyes are on Paris's fire-ravaged Notre Dame, New York's St. John the Divine Cathedral is dealing with the aftermath of a fire of its own. This is by Jane Margulies of the New York Times. All eyes are on Paris's fire-ravaged Notre Dame, which President Emmanuel Macron of France has pledged to restore in 5 years. But a great cathedral in New York is also recovering from a conflagration that occurred on Palm Sunday, one day before the medieval French Notre Dame was overcome by flames. The fire at the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine, a Gothic-style landmark in the Morningside Heights neighborhood of Manhattan, was far less catastrophic. It was confined to a windowless room in the crypt and no one was injured. The cause has been declared unknown. Still, oil paintings and an 18th-century icon were destroyed and other artworks damaged, and the plumes of smoke that rose up through heating vents in the floor into the cathedral's vast interior left soot everywhere. It doesn't sound so bad until you learn that smoke on stone acts as an acid, the Right Reverend Clifton Daniel III, the cathedral's leader, said in an interview on Monday. For months, crews from Maxon's Restorations have been scrubbing down walls with special heavy-duty brick-shaped sponges. Construction lifts, driven right onto the slate floor of the nave, carry them up to the 125-high-foot ceiling. With no room around the high altar to maneuver such heavy machinery, scaffolding is being installed there to put soiled surfaces within arm's reach. The stained glass windows are being vacuumed, the cast bronze entrance wiped down. The cathedral, the seat of the Episcopal Diocese of New York, remains open. A rented electronic organ is providing music until the 8,035 pipes of the cathedral's acclaimed Skinner instrument, which incidentally had recently been cleaned and reinstalled after a more serious fire in the cathedral in 2001, can be packed up and sent away again for cleaning. It's what you call an MESS, Dean Daniel said. He hopes the cleaning of the stonework will be completed by Christmas, and the cathedral will no longer look like a work site, with the organ restoration taking place next year. In parentheses, total cost, about $10 million. Until then, tour buses still disgorge passengers out front. But for the duration, with so many areas cordoned off, the usual $10 admission fee has been cut in half. We return to Religion News Service for our next article on religion in the news this week. This is a commentary by Rabbi A. James Rudin, who is listed as the American Jewish Committee's Senior Interreligious Advisor and the author of Pillar of Fire, a biography of Rabbi Stephen S. Wise. The title of this commentary, Christian Churches Own Up to the Futility of Converting the Jews. This was published on Religion News Service on September 27th. In July, the General Synod of the Anglican Church of Canada voted to remove a long-standing prayer from its liturgy that called for the conversion of the Jewish people to Christianity. The deleted wording will be replaced with a new invocation called for reconciliation with the Jews. Bishop Bruce Myers warned that persecution of Jews is not a thing of the past, nor is it restricted to other parts of the world. He cited last October's mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, which killed 11 worshipers. The bishop urged Anglicans to acknowledge and repent of the church's participation in anti-Semitism, to stop singling out Jews as a target for our evangelistic efforts, and to assume a humble and reconciliatory stance with our Jewish elders in the faith. Anglicans should be ever mindful of Christianity's deep Jewish roots. Almost from the beginning of Christianity, members of the new faith believed the Jewish people had lost God's favor because they rejected Jesus, a fellow Jew, as their Messiah and Savior. But of course, since the early followers of Jesus were Jews, there was no mass rejection, no vote was taken, no referendum was held in ancient Israel regarding the claims made about Jesus. However, as the church grew in adherence and influence, Christians began to believe they had won their rightful place as the religious successor to Judaism. The strong belief emerged that it was theologically necessary to convert Jews, the people of Jesus, to Christianity by whatever means necessary. As a result, for the past 2,000 years, Jews and Judaism have existed uneasily alongside Christians and Christianity. Tragically, throughout that history, church, in parentheses, and often political, authorities frequently employed horrendous physical, emotional, and psychological pressures in fruitless conversion campaigns. The Anglican Church's recent action joined similar steps taken earlier by major church bodies and prominent Christian leaders alike in a serious and systematic effort to rid Christianity of long-held teachings on conversion. That endeavor includes powerful statements from Popes John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and Francis, as well as from two of the most prominent Protestant leaders of the last 100 years, Billy Graham and Reinhold Niebuhr. In 1973, Graham declared, "I believe God has always had a special relationship with the Jewish people. In my evangelistic efforts, I have never felt called to single out Jews as Jews. Just as Judaism frowns on proselytizing that is coercive or that seeks to commit men against their will, so do I." 15 years earlier, Niebuhr was even more blunt. "Christian missionary activity among the Jews are wrong not only because they are futile, they are wrong because the two faiths, despite differences, are sufficiently alike for the Jew to find God more easily in terms of his own religious heritage than by subjecting him to a faith which must appear as a symbol of an oppressive majority culture. Practically nothing can purify the symbol of Christ as the image of God in the imagination of the Jew from the taint with which ages of Christian oppression in the name of Christ tainted it." In his early writings, Martin Luther hoped the Jews, the kinspeople of Jesus, would convert en masse to Christianity. When that did not happen, the great Protestant reformer mounted a fierce attack on Jews and Judaism. In 1543, Luther wrote Von den Juden und ihren Lügen, on the Jews and their lies. But in recent years, Lutheran church bodies in both the United States and Europe have publicly faced up to the reformer's horrific words and officially distanced themselves from Luther. Franklin Sherman, who taught at the Lutheran Seminary in Chicago, led the successful campaign to recognize and repudiate Luther's reprehensible teachings. Eugene J. Fisher, distinguished professor of theology at St. Leo University and former head of the Secretariat for Catholic-Jewish Relations for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, has accurately summed up the current Roman Catholic position on attempts to convert Jews. "The Second Vatican Council Declaration, Nostra Aetate, stresses that the covenant between God and the Jewish people, as the Bible states in many places, is irrevocable. Both Jews and Christians are equally the people of God. The logical conclusion of this official church teaching is that Jews do not need to convert to Christianity in order to be saved. They already are saved. Thus, the church's approach to Jews cannot be to proselytize or try to convert them. It must be one of dialogue between two peoples of God who are bound together by a common Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, and the fact that Jesus lived and died a faithful Jew." But sometimes it doesn't require popes, synods, church leaders, or Christian denominations to grasp and affirm a profound religious truth. Nearly 400 years ago, Andrew Marvell, a gifted English poet, recognized the futility of trying to convert Jews to Christianity when he composed To His Coy Mistress, a brilliant literary attempt to win the love of an unnamed woman. Marvell well knew his intense efforts at seduction would be lengthy and ultimately fail, just as the long centuries of intense Christian efforts to bring the Jewish people to the baptismal font would not succeed. "Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews." And we'll wrap up religion in the news this week with an article from the Associated Press. This is dated September 30th, and the headline, "Pope Meets with Jesuit Targeted by Right for Gay Outreach." This is by Nicole Winfield of the Associated Press, Dateline Vatican City. Pope Francis met privately Monday with an American Jesuit who has been attacked by conservative U.S. Catholics for reaching out to gays, the latest evidence of Francis's willingness to shrug off right-wing criticism for the sake of his pastoral priorities. The Vatican listed the audience with the Reverend James Martin among the Pope's daily activities, in a sign that Francis wanted it publicized. Since only some of Francis's private meetings are announced, the implicit message was a public vote of confidence in Martin's ministry. Martin, author of Building a Bridge, a book about how the Catholic Church should reach out more to the LGBT community, has had several talks canceled in the United States because of pressure from conservative groups who oppose his advocacy. The Vatican under Francis has welcomed him, however, appointing him as a communications consultant, giving him a speaking slot at a 2018 Vatican-sponsored family rally, and now a private papal audience. In a tweet, Martin said during the 30-minute meeting he shared with Francis the joys and hopes and the griefs and anxieties of LGBT Catholics and LGBT people worldwide. In a telephone interview, Martin said Francis listened intently to his presentation, delivered in Spanish, about the struggles of LGBT Catholics and how many of them still feel marginalized by the Church. "I felt encouraged, consoled, and inspired by our meeting," he said. "It was like talking to the most compassionate parish priest you can imagine." Official church teaching calls for gay men and lesbians to be respected and loved, but considers homosexual activity intrinsically disordered. Francis, though, has sought to make the church more welcoming to gays, most famously with his 2013 comment, "Who am I to judge?" The Argentine Jesuit has also spoken of his own ministry to gay and transgender people, insisting they are children of God, loved by God, and deserving of accompaniment by the church. Some conservative Catholics, especially in the U.S., have accused Martin of blasphemy and of spreading a homosexualist agenda. Many of them belong to the small but loud Francis opposition, a wing that the Pope recently acknowledged when he told reporters that he was honored to be attacked by Americans and wasn't afraid of schism by conservatives in the U.S. church. In a tweet, Rorate Cheli, a traditionalist blog that has been critical of Francis, noted that Martin's audience was listed alongside that of an entire bishop's conference. "If that's not an endorsement, nothing is," read the tweet. Damian Thompson, associate editor at Britain's The Spectator, a conservative news magazine, said Francis's aim in meeting with Martin was intended to taunt the U.S. conservatives that he demonizes. Many of Francis's critics argue he has confused the faithful with his mercy over morals priorities and flexibility on doctrinal issues such as sacraments for divorced and civilly remarried Catholics. New Ways Ministry, a Catholic ministry for the LGBT community, praised the audience and said it showed that Martin's ministry was being recognized and valued at the highest levels of the church. "It is a clear signal that Pope Francis is calling the church to conversion away from the negative messages it has sent in the past about LGBTQ people," said the head of New Ways Ministry, Francis DiBernardo. "It is a day of celebration for LGBTQ Catholics who have longed for an outstretched hand of welcome from the church that they love." Martin was in Rome for the plenary meeting of the Vatican's communications department, as well as for the consistory Saturday to name 13 new cardinals. And we'll wrap up religion in the news this week with a short AP article titled, "European Court Orders Bosnia to Remove Orthodox Church." This is from October 1st, Dateline Sarajevo. The European Court of Human Rights has ordered Bosnia to remove a Serbian Orthodox church that it says was illegally built on land owned by a Bosnian Muslim war widow after she and her family were forced to flee their village during the country's 1992-95 war. Fata Orlovic and 13 other family members have been fighting a legal battle to have the church removed since 2000, when she returned to Kunjevic Polja in eastern Bosnia, part of the country run by Serbs since the end of the war. The church was built shortly after Orlovic and her family were expelled from the village, 20 kilometers or 12 miles east of Srebrenica. Bosnian Serb forces killed thousands of Bosnian Muslims, including Orlovic's husband and over 20 other relatives, in the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. In its ruling on Tuesday, the court sided with members of the Orlovic family, ordering Bosnian authorities to remove the church from their land within 3 months from the date when the judgment becomes final. The court also ruled that Bosnia must pay damages to 14 members of the Orlovic family, totaling €31,000, or $33,800. Well, that's all the time we have this week for Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed the program, and thank you very much for listening. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program was generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. We thank them for their contribution. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.